Welcome to Minority Corner, where we take an introspective look at the world through an intersectional lens. I'm James, he, him. I'm a queer political activist, actor, comedian, self-proclaimed sexy blurb. That's a black nerd. And each week, I'm joined in the corner by other fabulous minorities and some allies tackling the news, pop culture, politics, media, entertainment, and history with a little self-care, self-love sprinkled throughout, all for our own personal and collective empowerment.
Happy Pride, Corner Kids. Yes, Pride season is here, and we have back to help bring in Pride season this year. Avi Roque is back. You know them, you love them. Latinx, queer, trans, non-binary actor, voice artist. We love them so much, and they're here, and we are just going to dive in all the Pride goodness. But first, Generation on HBO Max, we dive into it in deep because Avi has a very special connection. You're going to hear some backstage scuttlebutt about HBO Max's amazing queer-tastic Generation show. And for those of you who are a certain generation, you'll remember another channel that was doing the most. It was Nickelodeon. We both actually watched a documentary about the history of Nickelodeon. Very fascinating stuff. Some not so fascinating things happening behind the scenes. What is being done with the Italian voice dubbing for Laverne Cox's character in Promising Young Woman. Then in the main corners, we dive into Legendary Schwam. We talk about HBO's Legendary, and then I dive into the history of ball culture. You think you know, but you really have no idea. When do you think ball culture actually started? Huh? What do you think? And we dive into what is it? What is ball culture, its significance, and its impact on pop culture music today? We owe so much to this culture, and we are going to give back today. And then Avi leads us into some really great stuff happening in animation for LGBTQIA plus folks. A lot of great queerness happening in animation. We dive in so much, all this and more, as we celebrate Pride here on Minority Corner. Time to learn, laugh, and play. All right. Oh my gosh, Avi, welcome back to the show. Happy Pride. I am so excited. This is so great. It feels so fitting because a year ago, we were in the middle of the Ponte replay, and we had you here for Pride Week celebration, and here we are a year later, helping us to kick off Pride season, and things are very different, actually. I almost said they're a little different. I would say things are pretty different than they were a year ago.
I'd have to agree with that. Like, it feels almost surreal, like last year did not happen, right? Is that a general feeling
I think that's fair. Yeah, it is almost, because we were even talking like, what do we even do? And it was just, you know, there's a lot of drag queens performing in their rooms. We got to see them, you know, performing in their kitchens and things like that. And so this year it looks like Release the Kraken, people are, you know, vaccinated and they're going to be, you know, celebrating outside. And I read this thing of like, you know, really, you know, Pride is this, you know, giant ass celebration of a protest that is still raging. And I felt like that was like the best sort of description of like, what is Pride? You know, it's a celebration of a protest that is still going on strong, right? And so I think it's both of those things. It's us partying and also celebrating and also protesting, because there's a lot of tomfool fuckery going on against the queer community, specifically against our trans folks.
I mean, this is true, and it's sad to, you know, think that this is still the case and that we're still here fighting those battles. But yes, I guess we can try to look at the little bits of progress that are happening. You know, sometimes it's like that's all we have to like grasp onto. So, yeah.
Okay, the other thing that I want to say while you're here is, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Happy belated birthday. I've been waiting till I got you online to say this to you on air, because I felt so bad
I missed your birthday. I never miss your birthday. I usually get around the ballpark and I send you a bunch of emojis and like a little well wishes. And then I was like, cruise around. It May has been a whirlwind of a month. It was nonstop, booked, busy, and blessed. It was just so nonstop. And then I was scrolling through Instagram. I guess I had a moment and I saw it was your birthday. And then so much shame just came over me. And it was like late, like your birthday had been happened. And this post was from like a week or so ago. And I just felt so much shame that I could have in that moment been like, happy birthday. And instead I just went further into my shame cave and just said nothing. And happy birthday. So you sparkle magical pony ducky you.
Thank you. I will still take the birthday wishes. Whenever. It could be July. You could be like, happy birthday, beach.
Good to know. Don't let that shame monster, attack you. Like when you are ready to say happy birthday, when you remember, say it up. I'll be like, it'll be December 31st. I'll be like, oh shit. Oh, Avi, you know what? Happy birthday. I forgot. I want to get this in before the year ends. Here you go.
That's funny. No, yes. Thank you. I appreciate it. And it's all good. It's all good.
Go ahead. All right. Good. Okay. I've been wanting to talk about this we barely talked about this before on this show, and you are the perfect person to have this conversation with because you have an extra connection to this. It's interesting because I was just saying recently, I feel like there's not a lot of like queer like programming. There's not a lot of like queer, shows. I was watching, I watched It's a Sin, and it had been such a while since I'd seen like queer stories, like in TV shows. And then Generation popped up and I was like, holy fuckballs, this show is wild and amazing and go off like Generation Z. It is so great. I love the show so much. It's so good.
I'm just going to say thank you. I'm just kidding. But no, not kidding. Yeah, it is a fantastic show. And it's fantastic to have this in the canon just of, queer television now or having queer representation on television and especially with the young folks. And it's really awesome because my partner, my fiance, Christina Nieves, actually got to write. Was in the writer's room for that show. And it's really beautiful too, just kind of like she started off as the writer's assistant and then got bumped up to a staff writer.
Whoa, follow your dream, kids, and keep working, work hard, because that is wild. That is amazing. And like how, because I saw one of your posts on like Instagram before I saw your birthday post. But I saw this one, it was like, my boo helped write, like, it was the finale, and that finale was so fucking good. And also like Justin Smith, Justin Smith is like in everything these days. I remember seeing him. He was on Baz Luhrmann's The Get Down. He was the lead character in that. And then he was in that Jurassic World movie that wasn't great, but he was good. And then he was the lead in the Detective Pikachu movie. And then he's also in this series. So I just like, and like, I don't know, like it's sort of like a modern day, I think like a modern, this is just because this is what I grew up with, but like a modern day 90210 in the sense that it's like kids and their drama and their journeys and their challenges, but very much from like a queer teen perspective, which you just like never get.
I agree. I think like, there's so much of this, like, I feel like there's this realness, this rawness about it. Like, it just feels like, it feels genuine or it feels authentic in some way, Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it's super cool. And also, like, then I think about, like, Degrassi, right? Like, that was,
Yeah, very much so. Okay, you're right. Like, it's way more in line with Degrassi than 90210, which was just about rich, white, cisgender, straight people. But that's what I did not get Degrassi. I didn't have it. Not that I didn't get it, but it just wasn't available. I didn't have access to it. I think it was on the Disney Channel. But anyways, it's way more in line with that. You are correct. But Generation, I love it. Like, 9 episodes, so good. I love the way that they tell the story. There's the... I love a good flashback. I love a good, like, meeting different kids at different times. The first episode, the pilot, is just so genius. I love a story where it's like you meet different people and then it's like, oh, but what was that person's experience that day? And you see things through their perspective. And also I thought it was like a really great, although I think what's interesting from my understanding is that the writers are probably like not Generation Z, but it is a show about Generation Z. But I think they've done a really good job, I think, of capturing that voice. I think better than like, usually when older people are writing shows about teens, it's just off the mark. Like when you think about the folks who wrote Saved by the Bell, it was sort of like, I have this theory that it's probably just like a bunch of straight white dudes writing their thoughts about teenagers and how they are, or how they really want them to be, right? Whereas I feel like this show really feels like it's got some authenticness. Like, do they just like hang out with like, how do they get the good realness from them, or just watch their Instagrams? Like, it is very fascinating how it feels like, and again, I'm a millennial, so I don't know, but I also know that like 1 in 6 Gen Zers are queer in some aspect. You know, they're so like not about like labels and things like that. They're so much further along on that than we were allowed to be, I will say, because you're only going to be as go as far as the boundaries that were somewhat put in front of you, right? And I think they're standing on our very queer ass shoulders. Like, we did what we could do in the world that we had. We had George Bush, okay? It was 9/11 happened and everything was like pro-America, fuck anything else that's not that. Like, it was, you were labeled a terrorist if you weren't just all about pro-America during those 2000s. So it was a very conservative time period. We don't think about how conservative the 2000s were. That's my tirade.
Super conservative. Just gonna. It was. Yeah.
It was. Like, to go from the 90s, which, like, I mean, you remember watching, like, MTV and stuff like that. It was, like, there's, like, this, it was about rule breaking. And it was, like, this, like, you know, sexual is, it was, like, sex was everywhere. And I would watch The Real World and learn about stuff. And then the 2000s hit and 9/11 happened. And it was much more conservative. Even just, like, you think about, like, 90s teen movies, like American Pie. Like, it was, like, this raunch. But the 2000s happened and it was, like, Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen in New York Minute. Like, it went a very different direction than where we were before. It was like this family values like stuff, you know?
No, it was. Yeah. And I feel like that's why, well, sorry, because I'm still hung up on a part that you were talking about like the people in the room, like who were writing these stories. Mm. And I feel like it was a team of like POC and queer writers, but you're right. Like, I mean, they yep. were the, there was, so it's two gay dads and their daughter, Zelda, who, yeah. And oh no, did I just, their child, Zelda, their kid, Zelda, mm-hmm. Who's adopted. Mm-hmm. And I know that Zelda was also in the room as well and is of the generation. Because the idea stemmed from something that Zelda wrote, basically, like as I think a prompt or an exercise, oh. Maybe, or maybe not. Wow, look at me in my facts, please.
I know. It's totally fine. It's fine. We're chit-chatting, having a conversation. But that's fascinating though, because there are two gay dads featured in the show, and I wonder if that's them kind of writing themselves. It's a show with two gay dads who kind of like kicked off the premise for this show. That is amazing.
Yeah, they are the creators.
I didn't know that. That is amazing. 2021, go off. Like,
it's a family affair.
I'm here for that. I know, there's always like these. I fucking love it. That is so great. I love that so much. Okay, so the room in that makes sense. And it shows like. In its writing, it absolutely does.
And that's what I appreciate too, is like you were saying about the characters, it's so character driven. And I think every character is so well thought out and like has an arc and is so specific, you know? So I think that helps kind of people to latch on or want to root or cheer for someone or be like, you know, it's just very well written. And I think it's that final episode, and more episodes are going to be released. So they wanted to do it in two parts.
Oh,
Yeah.
I
oh
see.
No, I hope okay. that wasn't a spoiler. I'm all like, am I supposed to be talking about this?
No, that's... Well, I think you should, because people are on pins and needles, like, waiting for, this is good. People know that there's more that is coming, because I thought I was going to have to wait a whole entire year for, like, because it's, I think, 8 episodes that have been released so far, and, like, wait an entire year for another 8. Like, no, this was a gift. Thank you for giving us that gift. Even though your boo might come in and be like, don't say that, but no, I'm just kidding. It's fine. You heard it first here in Minority Corner. We got the scoop. You got the scoop. Such a fucking really great show. If you're not watching it, you're doing it wrong. Go up, get up on that show. Yeah, that cliffhanger definitely like left me hanging and like wanting more. So I like, can't wait. I want more. Okay, something kind of we were talking about that kind of made me think of this. I recently watched this documentary on Hulu called The Orange Years, and it's about Nickelodeon. And it came out in 2018. It's such a good documentary. I don't know if you've seen it, but like it is. I was watching it, and my body lit up with so much joy watching it, because I realized that was my childhood. Like, I didn't realize how much, like, I always say, like, oh, MTV raised me. Correction, MTV and Nickelodeon raised me. Like, I spent hours in front of like watching this like programming, and the documentary, it takes you from like its genesis. And the thing about I would highlight about it is that Nickelodeon was a network run by a woman, and for like at least the first 15 years, and a lot of the heads of programming and people who are running shows were also women. And I think it makes a difference in terms of the programming, because I'm not sure. I just think, like, I think in the 80s and even the early 90s, you had a lot of, like, out-of-touch dudes, primarily white dudes, who had this idea of what kids and youth were and what they were doing, and it was just garbage. Just garbage.
It was, and I did watch it, so I quickly was like, what? Gotta watch this. And you're right, there was such a nostalgic just feeling about it, and you're right. I had that moment, too, similarly, where I was like, wow. Like, I really was raised with, like, watching, like, cartoons and, like, so much, like, kids programming in television.
Yeah. But I think what's interesting about Nickelodeon, what is so different about it, is because most cartoons from, like, the 80s and 90s, cartoons were made to sell toys. And Nickelodeon was the reverse. They actually were like, we're here to create these stories. And, like, the merchandising came second. And they actually were really... not really about it in the beginning stages. And you think there wasn't a lot of Nickelodeon type merchandising or toys compared to like anything else, right? Like Transformers, Ninja Turtles, or any of those G.I. Joes, like those were all these cartoons were made. They're like, oh, we got to sell a toy. Here's a cartoon. And then it was just interesting to watch like the genesis of it. Like it was originally this network called Pinwheel. And then it started, I forgot that Nickelodeon first was actually all like mostly scripted. Their original programming was all the scripted stuff. And they had purchased other shows from other countries. So you can't do this on television, which had Alanis Morissette. But you can't do this on television, which was a Canadian show and was really... the genesis of everything is about Nickelodeon, where you get like slime, like people would get slimed on the show. And it was like weird and subversive, and really felt like it had like a kid's actual voice. They were doing like sketch comedy from like these kids' perspectives. And one thing that Nickelodeon never did is it never talked down to kids. Like, so like Salute Your Shorts is a very like authentically like kid youthful show. It wasn't, because you watch stuff on the Disney Channel, it was just so, you know, laugh track, and it was so, we'd watch it, but it felt not real or genuine. It was that Disney sort of magic. Whereas Nickelodeon was like, it felt like MTV's younger sibling, you know? It was like, we're just kind of off doing our own thing, to the point where actually some of the same creatives, the guys who created the MTV logo, or the same folks that did the Nickelodeon one with, like, the orange, like, splat, you know? And they talk about it a lot, is that, like, it's, like, doing weird things on Nickelodeon. And it's like, oh, yeah, like... Rugrats, they were drawn, they were hideous, and the woman was like, she's like, yeah, I wanted them, babies are not cute when they first come out, like, so that's why all the babies are, like, really ugly, and, like, you know, the things that they can get away with, like, Ren and Stimpy, like, it was just, like, this was not Disney, it was just doing something completely different, and it was mostly, like, just women and really artistic people behind the scenes, and when you watch that documentary, you're like,
oh, this all makes sense. This is what I felt like. This is what I thought I was watching, and now it makes
full
sense.
Full circle moment.
That's what I was watching.
Right? Like, no. It was, no. And it was so great to just learn some of the history,
yes.
too. That's why I love documentaries. So, like, I love just getting, you know, like, more insight into the creation of things and to see the origins of that and how it evolved. And, you know, they're here now. They're here now still. But,
yeah.
like, they had a prime time, I feel like, you know. It definitely.
Oh, yeah. It was that 90s. When that woman, when she was in charge of it, I would say. Because she was there for 15 years. And I think when she left, it's not the same as it. It became more corporatized. Once they shut down Nickelodeon Studios, because they had, like, a Nickelodeon Studios, like, complete, like, legit. And I always wanted to go. But being in California, my family's not going to fly us all the way over to Florida to go. It was like, that's just like an East Coasters thing. I always wanted to go so bad, or be on Wild and Crazy Kids, or like be on Legends of the Hidden Temple. I would pretend like I'd be watching Legends of the Hidden Temple and pretend like, okay, I'm with the Blue Barracudas today. I got to get over this lava. Oh, I got to get into this temple. Don't you kidnap me. Don't you? Okay, well, you kind of look at that hunky man. But don't you kidnap me. And I felt so bad for those poor traumatized kids in Legends of the Hidden Temple. Kids rarely won that fucking competition because it was so – you had to earn enough time to go into the temple. If you didn't get a full 3 minutes – forget about it. They're like, oh, you only have a minute to go find the three pieces of the missing monkey statue. Another time, and then some guy would come out and kidnap you. You know?
Yeah, made it impossible. Impossible.
It was so. I like once saw somebody maybe win, and then you had to like tag your partner to go in. It just was. There was a lot of things, but you learn something too in Legend of the Hidden Temple. There'd be like a history like lesson of that day, like the mystery of, you know, Queen Khalifa or something, you know.
What was the large stone talking? What was it? Olmec?
Olmec. Yes. Okay. Olmec. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And then, when they were talking about like when they did like Hey Dude, there was a bunch of like first time writers. Ben Stiller's ex-wife, Christine Taylor, who played Melody on that show.
Right.
They were like, yeah, there was a lot of people falling in troughs. They'd be like, ugh, we need something to do in this scene. They're falling in a trough. And there's just that was when all else fails, you just do that. But it's such a great documentary. Highly recommend it. It's so well done. My only qualm, it was too short. I think they could have done it as like a multiple part series because I think you could spend like 20 minutes on Salute Your Shorts alone. Like, you know, or like I would like an hour on tell me all the stories about what happened on Salute Your Shorts. I do want to say that snaps to Demi Lovato recently came out as non-binary. We love that for Demi. There's a lot of great stuff happening in terms of breaking down these further boundaries of like, you know, queerness. I will say this, though, something that was not great is that so Promising Young Woman came out. Fabulous, amazing movie. Laverne Cox's best acting and like really good. There are sometimes when I see Laverne Cox and I'm like, I don't know if you're the best actor or actress, but like sometimes I don't necessarily think it's their fault if you don't have the right director to really work with you. And I think sometimes queer people or people of color, directors don't know how to work with us sometimes, you know? They kind of just don't really know how to give us direction. And I don't know what that is. I know the first time I worked with a black gay director, it was a night and day experience. They were able to just be like, no, don't do this anymore. Like there's certain things that we maybe are doing that are kind of cheating and quote unquote as our acting tricks. Right. And when you have a director who's a part of your community, they're much more able to cut through some of the bullshit that you might do to get you to your more authentic performance. And I think that's what happened with Laverne Cox in Promising Young Woman. And she did an amazing job. I was like, okay, you're amazing. But then I believe it was the Italian version of it that was released and they had like the dubbing of it. They didn't get another like a trans actress over there to do the voice. They got a man to do the voice, which is so fucked up on so many levels. Who, what, how, I don't even understand.
First of all, like, you know, yes, I haven't seen it yet, so It's on my gotta watch. But
yeah,
that's just like
put on the list. Put on the list.
Put on the list. That's just like, you know, it seems like right, like a huge oversight, but that means that someone has that belief. Like someone is right? No, is that not wrong? Like someone is transphobic?
Yeah.
That is literally the definition.
This is the definition of transphobia happening right then and there. It seems like you said it seems like it almost, it's so fucked up that it almost seems like malicious. And a lot of times I try to give like the benefit of the doubt, but this seems such like a deliberate, like you couldn't even get like, I don't know, your Italian version of Scarlett Johansson, right? Like at least it's like still not great. It should be like a trans woman to do the voice, but it's a bunch, it almost seems like a fuck you or a slap in the face to do, you know, like it's so wrong on so many levels.
It is. And I did Laverne Cox do a statement or like a response to it? Do you know?
Great question. I hadn't seen anything. And in some ways I think that, you know what, Laverne Cox doesn't need to. I think the studio, Italian studio needs to come out and say something, or even the director, you know, this is one of those moments where allies step up, right? This should be the other co-stars should be stepping up and saying something in that moment, because like that is so hurtful and that should not have happened. And it's not on Laverne Cox to have to correct this or even educate about this. This is like all hands on deck for everybody else.
Right. No, I agree. I think in my head I was just like, what would I have done? Been like, yeah, would I have stayed silent, or would have I been like,
Yeah,
fuck you, that's wrong. probably not, you know, because, you know, it's still, you're still in the public eye, you know, and it matters how you carry yourself and what you say. But I think you made a valid point around it's not her place to have to say anything. It's about other people stepping up, allies, and which was it Universal?
Yeah, it was Universal Pictures International. Yeah. And they did say that they, you know, have since come back and they're like, oh, there wasn't any malicious intent. It was a mistake. I just don't understand how that is a mistake, because you have to go through, you do like audio work and there's a huge casting process. Like there was, they said, here are the actors, here's what we need. Here are the voices, what we need. Here's what we're casting for. And that got approved on so many different lines and channels. And people, you know, there's a lot of people that signed off on that for a long time. And until like someone was like, hold on, what are y'all doing? Did they then go, oh, sorry, you know, this was a mistake. That's not a mistake. Right. I don't know. Someone recorded all of this shit and got paid.
Yeah.
You know, like it was that, like, that's not just a mistake there. They are now going back to redubbing with female actors in their international territories. And they're actually pushing back the release date to ensure that a correct version is available.
But, it does. It just perpetuates that like harmful, what is it like that stereotype around like,
it's a harmful stereotype, and it's sort of, it's regressive in a lot of ways, and it's also hurtful to the individual who is being their true authentic self, and you're still personally like, you as the industry are putting them and their performance in this box of your ignorant idea of who they are.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, and this is maybe me being like, it's still fucked up, and I still believe that. And I'm like, okay, I understand you're trying to maybe match a voice, and that's what's so fucked up with just like, you know, trans women who are women, and like, what is the voice? Like, so it is fucked up, because it's like we're still judging off of like tonally what a voice sounds like and pitch and everything like that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, I still get tripped up when sometimes I'm on the phone and someone's like, hello, ma'am, like, you know, and like still misses or ma'ams me. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's fine. You know?
All right. Okay. Wow, that is, but in this journey for yourself of what you're going through and going on, and then like And I'm sure what's so heartbreaking is like, it's, but yeah, I don't, I'm so, that makes me shake trees. And you're in a much better Buddhist state about it than I would be. Because it's sort of like, you're like, no, but this is who I, you're still seeing me as this. And I don't know, maybe it puts you doubt into your own self and your own work that you're doing, like on your own journey. But it's interesting how much like weight we put on. And this is why I think just in general, gender conformity hurts everybody. Cause I, and not to try to take the spotlight, but you know, I remember when I was a kid and they'd be like, hello, young lady, is your mom there? And you know, I'm like 8 years old. And it, you know, when you're growing up in this patriarchal society and you're a young 8 year old boy who also is terrified about being like, you know, possibly anything effeminate or gay, because that is like a death sentence, right? And but again, like with all of these rules, look at all those like mental gymnastics or things that I used to have to put myself through. And I used to hate answering the phone. I used to hate talking on the phone. I was taught to like hate my voice for so long because of what we perceive of like what a certain gender gender's voice is, right? And it just sends people into their own head. It should just be in a world where it just sort of fucking like either, you know, doesn't matter. So we actually, you know, someone says that, it rolls right off my back because we know that there's nothing wrong with any of, you know, the genders, right? We all fully know that and understand that. Or two, it's just like, it's such a construct and it's not a thing. We have a, we've evolved language where it's moved beyond gender. Should I be a writer for Generation Now? Can I? Am I?
Yes.
Was that okay? Is that something one of the kids would say?
Absolutely.
I mean, I might be 35 going on 36, but I clearly like have it locked in. I just, I'm ahead of my time. I'm really just a 16-year-old human.
Yes,
at heart.
That's what you need, though. You need to be plugged in. You need to be plugged in to all the social medias, the TikTok.
No, don't do that. Oh, you! I knew you were going to say that TT word. I don't want it. No. Okay. Well, I can't do it. So I'm withdrawing my application. If I have to be on the TikToks and the Vines, is Vine a thing? Are they still doing that? No. Are they on Vine? I have a MySpace.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, Lord.
Okay. All right. We're going in the wrong direction. Okay. We're going to take a short break. And then when we come back, kicking off Pride season, what better to do it than ball culture? And we're going to do the history of ball culture. And you think you know ball, but you ain't got no idea.
Legendary. Legendary.
Hey, it's John Moe. And look, these are challenging times for our mental and emotional health. I get it. That's why I'm so excited for my new podcast, Depresh Mode. We're tackling depression, anxiety, trauma, stress, the kinds of things that are just super common but don't get talked about nearly enough. Conversations that are illuminating, honest, and sometimes pretty funny with folks like Patton Oswalt, Open Mike Eagle, and Kelsey Dara.
Now I can kind of go like, oh yeah, there's that thing where I feel like I'm in a video game and my hands aren't real and I'm living the Truman Show. Okay, this too shall pass.
Plus psychiatrists, psychologists, and all kinds of folks. On Depresh Mode, we're working together, learning, helping each other out. We're a team. Join our team. Depresh Mode for maximum fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. Yes, my excellency. Yes, yes. So I'm working on finding like non-gendered royalty like slogans and tie-ins. So, like, yes, Your Eminence, yes, Your Excellence, yes, Majesty, yes, right? We're trying to go away from, because king and queen are so gendered. And so, my liege, yes, my liege.
I love that. All these titles of royalty. All right. I love it.
Yes, I'm going on other titles. Yes, Your Excellency, yes. I like that. Yes, Your Highness, yes, Your Eminence. Isn't that nice? Look at you. Give me that duck walk.
I can't. My knees are just.
You are.
My knees.
Oh, I mean, same. We'll get to there. But you were giving me. You were giving me a lot of. You were giving me a lot of Vogue femme yes. Queen. So that was that with the hands.
I do.
Which
love
you can
it.
Do that. You know, you got that. It. Yes.
Okay, so I want to admit, I am late to the party, and I just watched season one of Legendary. So now season two is up and running. And I think you were the one last year during Pride. You're like, I watched Legendary, and I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, and we didn't talk about it. Am I correct on that?
I think you're right. You've
seen the first season. Yeah, you said it, and I was like, I don't know. And I had seen Pose, and I'm like, we could talk about that, yes. Legendary, what is it? It is, I would equate it to, you know, it's like, it feels like it's like Drag Race meets America's Best Dance Crew meets American Idol, but set in the ball culture. You have 9 houses. Each week there's a theme. One team is eliminated. I cried so much watching this fucking show. Like, I don't know if like other people cried during, like, I don't watch American Idol. I don't know if people ever cry during it. I can't imagine you would. Like, the stories that you're hearing from this community, I think this is probably one of the best reality television shows about the queer community. And I just think even more so than Drag Race. I don't really watch Drag Race. I appreciate that it exists. I think it's a little watered down version of what I know for like what drag queens do. Like, to me, Drag Race, the real part of the show is when they do their lip sync battle. I would think the whole entire show, it should just be more of that and not like make a costume, but you're in a tank of bees and it's just sort of like, you know, or you're skydiving and having to put on your makeup. Like, it's just so, I'm like, this is not what drag queens are really doing. So what I love about Legendary is, I think, as much as it is still like, okay, we've got to make this for a wide, you know, mainstream audience, I feel like you're getting a huge taste of what the ballroom culture is, the queer community, the stories that you will hear from them, and why ball is so important. So I think that the judges are always crying because someone's always to go home. And you love them. Like, even like you end up loving all the teams and all the participants and all the houses. And when you see like they cry and the judges cry, like, it's just like, especially like the last 5 episodes, like someone's crying all the time. Like, even the judges. It's so beautiful.
It is so beautiful. If I can just comment, I haven't finished season 2 yet.
Oh, I haven't even started it. I just finished season. I did season 1 all this past weekend. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
I said I was late to the party. I am. Yeah. I meant it. I'm late. Y'all are already on to the next party. And I'm like, oh, I just got here. What's going on? What are we doing?
Well, I'm so happy that you've joined.
You try to tell me. You know what? I need to, you know what? Listen to Avi. That is the theme. Listen to Avi, everybody. When Avi says something, listen. Because you try to tell me about the COVID, and I was like, no, whatever. You try to tell me about Legendary, I'm like, what are you talking about? I need to listen to you more often. I don't know why I don't.
That's so
You're like,
funny.
It's my birthday, and I'm like, no, I don't know. What is it? Okay, late. I am late to the party, and you were ahead of your time. You were ahead of your time.
That's a first. I feel sometimes a little not very plugged in, so that's good.
You are ahead of me where it matters. So what is ball culture? Mm. Okay, sit back. I'm going to learn you. I'm going to learn you something. Okay, my liege, your highness. I really liked you. I really like it. I like that. Because then I can say it for anybody. Because like, I have like queen is in like my vocabulary so much. But like, I need to, I don't want to have to do the extra mental gymnastics and want to make sure I'm being as inclusive as possible. So, okay, your highness. It works for everybody. So, boom. All right, so it is a place for the ball culture. It's a place for Black, queer, and brown youth to convene after hours in community centers and other spaces to, quote unquote, walk, which is to compete by donning appropriate dress or attitude based on whatever the categories are that reflect and comment on popular culture and the mainstream, okay? So when you say mainstream, looking at the ball perspective, think about like white, straight, cisgender society, where a lot of these folks in the early days of ball were excluded from a lot of this. And I would say even still to today are still not entirely 110% included. And it is primarily a place, like I said, for Black, queer, and Latino youth to gather, unify, connect. And it really ball when you look at it, especially when you watch Legendary. I highly recommend everybody watch Legendary. Like, go a step further. You're like, oh, I'm already watching RuPaul's Drag Race. You can watch more than one queer reality competition show, and you're going to get the heart. This is the real. You're going in deep. And, you know, many of the things in pop culture, music, fashion, queer culture, they've emanated from underground ball culture. And so it's also like paying homage and respect as well. You know, terms like throwing shade, yes, queen, snatching trophies, slay, voguing,
reading people, libraries open. Like, so much of our stuff that we say came from here. And I think what is so sad is that these folks did not, had not, still do not get the credit that they deserve in terms of fame, accolades, and fortune, which a lot of them were aspiring to have and really wanted, but they were so underground and so on the excerpts, they weren't able to get. So we're going to pay tribute. Again, I could not imagine a better way to kick off Pride season than going back to like some of the roots of our queer prideful culture that was taken from us by not only straight folks, but also cisgender white dudes. Historically, this also, the ball culture would reflect the, you know, American dream and their exclusion from it. And, you know, many of the kids in the ball, in ball culture, they're many of them are homeless, were kicked out by homophobic or transphobic relatives, and they form their own families and houses. So it's just really beautiful community and culture. So, pop quiz, Avi. When do you think ball culture started? Give a guess. Like, do you have give a guess. When do you think ball culture started? Audience, play along. Look, Avi gets so stressed during these situations. It's okay that you don't know. You're not getting thrown off the show.
You gotta give me an A, B, C, and D.
No, I want you to just shoot in the dark. I usually would, but I just want... No, when do you think ball culture started?
Okay. I feel like for some reason, I feel like it's, honestly, it's going to be like way before what I'm going to say.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. Yeah, all right.
But okay. I could be wrong. I'm going to say the 70s.
Mm-hmm. In some ways,
okay,
you tell are me. Right, but you're not fully right because there's a full broad picture. And I like your hunch that you're like, I'm going to say 1970s. But I feel like it's so much sooner than that. The 1970s is when it really, really did start to really take off. You're absolutely right on that. But it goes back so much further. Okay. 1800s. Yes, let's go on a ride. I know, this is so fascinating. So they go back so much further. So we're going to go back to the 1800s, which is in this kind of wildest picture people in the 1800s. Well, it wasn't quite what it is now. They weren't necessarily voguing, you know? But they had balls. And so the Hamilton Lodge, I'm just imagining like someone in their pilgrim costume doing a duck walk, doing a death drop. No, running away from a slave catcher. It started off in New York. So obviously. So the Hamilton Lodge number 710 in Harlem was a club for well-to-do African-Americans. And they started throwing a charity masquerade gala at the annual Old Fellows Ball around 1867 to 1869 is when the first sort of ball started happening. But wild. Like the Civil War, like just ended. Abraham Lincoln just had been shot. And thereafter throwing balls up in Harlem. Like that's just to put that in context, is dangerous, and the Reconstruction is in the process of failing down in the South. That's where we are. So these balls would feature men in female drag and women in male drag. And the event was later known as the Faggots Ball or the Fairies Ball. In some ways, I kind of love that. Even back then, they were already like reclaiming that name, right? Like I kind of love it. They're like, okay, the Faggots Ball. And I'm like, but they named it that, right? Like, I am not mad at that. Y'all, they were the Generation Z of their time, really. This is what they are. And there would be prizes given out for most beautiful gown, most perfect feminine body displayed by an impersonator, which I think is so interesting because these are the same roots that are very much still alive and kicking in modern day ball with prizes and the pageantry, and people will come far and wide. And there was an article in 1886 from the black newspaper, the New York Freeman, which was later known as the New York Age. And they called it was the event of the season. And in 1929, right before the stock market crash, I think, because that came shortly after. In 1929, the ball reportedly had to turn away about 2,000 spectators. Yeah, they were like, 2,000 people got turned away because it was so busy. And then in 1936, middle of the Depression, they had 8,000 attendees. So
if you were in the Depression, you better go on over to Harlem, because that's where they are still serving it up, okay? And the Hamilton Lodge was for mainly for POC folks, but white folks would come in and dance. And so it was kind of interesting because you had, you know, this time period that was not necessarily this, you know, salad bowl of people. But here in this space, you would have people from different areas and backgrounds were able to come together. And then in 1932, an article from the Afro-American noted that our members of the third sex are showing a keenness for blonde wigs. So they would love to, and that's, they're acknowledging this other, and again, with the tools that they had available, you know, they identified it as the third sex, which I will say, culturally, you do have that even in, like, Polynesian cultures, or even in some First Nations cultures, this acknowledgement of something other than just these two things, the male and female, right? This acknowledgement of this third sort of space. And here you had in America, 1932, up in these balls, and they love blonde wigs.
Know. Well, I mean, well, it's so interesting because, yeah. I mean, when you think about, like, okay, a ball, like I'm thinking like Cinderella, like this kind of like event or gathering or party like existed as something, but this is different, you know, it like was taken and transformed and adapted to.
But I think what you're saying does make sense, that that's why we call it a ball, because back then they had balls, right? We don't really have a ball. We have like dance parties, right? Like nowadays, right? So it does make sense. Like, why would they have in the 1970s would they start just having what they would call balls? And maybe originally was thinking like, oh, because it was like, you know, elegance, which we'll get into, and that's what they're really adopting afterwards. But its roots were in from the time period when they literally had balls. They were still having balls back in the 1800s, you know.
Exactly.
And then in the 1927, a New York Age article described the judging process and a grand march, which led to several eliminations and six prizes being awarded. So this is like literally the foundation, prizes, judges, people getting chopped, as we call it. I'm also going to link in our show notes a glossary of terms for you all, so that way you can have them. But yes, you can get chopped. It's so sad when they get chopped. Chopped is when you get cut from a category. So you're like, okay, executive realness, Avi and I come out, I'm walking, but maybe my walk isn't selling it as much. I get chopped, Avi kills it, snatches the trophy, and Avi gets the glory, and James has to try another day. That works sometimes. So what was also really nice in the earlier days, there weren't police raids, which is a thing to, wow, that's very impressive. In the earlier days, there wasn't, but by 1938, they started cracking down. There was an article that 15, you know, folks were arrested. And these are the things that we used to have to survive and endure, you know, and people talk about, why is there a pride? This is part of it, because there was a time when we couldn't live our lives out and proudly. And in some ways, there's that journey is still very much real for some folks. And also in the early days of the balls, you still had class and racial divisions. They really tried to attract a diverse audience by lowering prices so everyone could attend. But there did, this won't surprise you, there evolved a sort of zoo-like atmosphere where you would have people just who would, you know, come and they would view from the top galleries and just sort of, it was like they're going to a zoo and seeing this, oh, wow, it's so exotic and look what they're doing. And there'd be, you know, middle-class men, you know, passing as straight, middle-class men who could pass for straight would sit in the balcony and just like looking down at the spectacle of, you know, these, you know, working men in drag. And it was just sort of this like thing to look at and gawk at, which, yeah, still holds up today, where you have, you know, straight people coming up into our clubs and it has a zoo-like experience, you know, touching cisgender women, like groping drag queens, you know, or go-go dancers. Like, there's just, it has this zoo-like experience that happens sometimes.
Yeah, and I feel like you would know too, because you've done the go-go dancing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's sort of this thing that we, I don't know. Learning what my own sort of boundaries are, especially within the queer community, and also for
for non-queer people and even queer people itself. Like, there's understanding what and everyone's boundaries are, consent in terms of touching. Sometimes, you know, there is, yes, for a part of the queer community, this, you know, liberation in sexuality, but maybe I'm not that all the time or in all this spaces or evolve in and out of it. And there becomes this thing sometimes where people just feel like they have access to touch your body all the time in those spaces. And that's not the case. Like, consent. Going back to the racial divide that was happening, Black queens were expected to whiten their faces if they expected to win prizes. And this is implied in the documentary. I haven't seen it. It's on my list. There's a 1968 documentary called The Queen by Frank Simon. Have you seen this? I think it's on Netflix.
No.
My Netflix knows me. They're like, you should watch this. I'm like, yeah. I'm getting around to it. They always write, you know. They're like you. They always tell me what I need to be watching.
And you don't listen.
exactly. And then 3 years later, I'm like, oh yeah, I was told to watch this. So it follows The Queen. It follows the 1967 All-American Camp Beauty Contest. And there's a famous scene where Crystal LaBeija, which we'll get to in a moment, accuses the contest of being rigged by Flawless Sabrina. And because Flawless Sabrina serves as the contest MC and the documentary narrator. And so anyways, like, Crystal LaBeija is already calling it out. And this is like, you know, 1968 and these beauty queen contests. And Pepper LaBeija said, you know, it was our goal then to look like white women. And they used to tell me, you have Negroid features. And I'd say, that's all right. I have white eyes. That's how it was back then. Like, that's where it was. And so with this evolution, that's where they were coming out of, right? And so what happened is the Black queens were like, okay, we need our own space. Like, that's what started to happen. So 1968 going into the 70s, then LaBeija is credited with staging the first Black drag ball in 1962, which led to the formation of houses. So now we're getting into where you were guessing, right? You didn't know about all that stuff in the 1800s, how they were getting down. And now we're getting to where you're like, oh, okay, I know this. I saw Paris is Burning. So the House of LaBeija may have been the first house found in about 1970, 1972-ish. And as legend has it, a Harlem drag queen named Lottie asked Crystal LaBeija to co-promote a ball. And Lottie had convinced Crystal LaBeija to do it. And Crystal LaBeija was like, fine, but only if I get to be the star of this. And she's like, okay, yeah, absolutely, girl, go for it. And so that happened, and then convinced her to create the House of LaBeija. And she was like, Crystal, you can be the mother, which means you can be like the leader of it. And, you know, taking these kids and really create this family and create these, you know, balls and these houses and these performances. And then, the house, you know, became a surrogate family for young, queer, Black and Latino kids who, again, were often estranged from their biological family. Some of them were living on the streets, turning tricks, doing whatever they could to, you know, get by. And these houses were literally like saving their lives. And there you would have the House of LaBeija was then formed. And then soon other houses throughout the 70s and 80s were formed. The House of Corey, the House of Dior, the House of Wong, the House of Dupree, the House of Extravaganza, the House of Plenty, all of these different houses. And they would all try to outdo each other by throwing their own balls. And each house would have like a mother. They were like the elder queer person who was oftentimes, which I think is so interesting. And that's what I really love about Pose, because I've seen different documentaries, but there was something about Pose that really not so much humanized it. There's something different when you're watching a documentary or then I love documentaries, but when you're actually just kind of getting to see people live in this world, there was something about just seeing how young the mothers were sometimes who would form their houses. But they would really take on this role of like they are the mother. But there would be such a respect, like, because there was this, people wanted that family connection. And so, like, when your you lived in that house, you lived with that mother's rules. You did what that mother said. Like, it was, you know, there was, they really played into these family dynamics. And, you know, these houses would compete for, you know, glory. You know, they competed as a family to bring glory in the form of trophies in their houses, just earning the title of legendary. Hence the title of this amazing HBO show. If you had enough wins to snatch those trophies and get those houses and those roses, Paris Dupree, who was the mother of House of Dupree, threw the first Paris's Burning Ball around 1981. And this was the first time categories really took precedence at the ball. So you would get most perfect feminine body, which is known as what cheesecake, that's called cheesecake in today. And so it's sort of, again, would be like, I guess, drag, sort of, they call it like, you know, this back in the day, they call it like impersonator or whatnot, but it definitely has evolved over the time. Butch Realness, Models Effect, Face. Face is a category where you just really get to just show off your face. You just walk up to the judges and they're just like, I don't know if you're, I will get to this in a moment, but I've been to a ball before and it is everything. It is everything. Other categories evolved, executive realness, right? And when you have the thing was like something realness, it was like portraying that in such like a real way that I just believe that you are this person, town and country. Ethnic was a category. Again, this is the 80s. People are still trying to figure out, you know. It would probably be someone like in a dashiki. It would be like, you know, that would be, you know, the ethnic category. But different times, look at it as a bubble. It's a time capsule. It's a museum. We look at it for what it is. We would not do that category today. But realness is performing that archetype. You know, it's a reflection of society. Honestly, it's a reflection of society for a world that they really couldn't be a part of. And, you know, like for executive, you know, these queens could not get jobs in the real world. They didn't have access, they didn't have the education or the background or opportunities. But Dorian Corey, who, you know, House of Corey said, you know, in a ballroom, you can be anything that you want. You're showing the straight world that I can be an executive if I had the opportunity because I can look like one. It's fulfillment. And so they got to play into these roles and to play into this and to get trophies and support and just to get uplifted. Like, doesn't everybody need the opportunity to express themselves and also be uplifted and to go from like the street, no family, to going out dressing like an executive and winning trophies?
That is such a beautiful thing. Like, you know, and that was so interesting too, like in learning also like how, yes, it's about like presentation and, but also like coming to, you know, show that you are so much more and that you can do so much more. You know, it was like, that's why I always think about like, why did I want to become an actor? Why is it like, you know, what is it? It's like, it is this like escape in this way, but like also I love that. It's like a note to the world, like a letter to the world or a statement of just being like, look at like who we are and like what we can be. And I think that's really powerful. And I think sometimes there's still like, which is so interesting in watching Legendary too, is like still some of like the binariness of it still, like the masculine, what is it? Like the masculine walk, like who can do the best, like masculine walk in like heels or something like that. It was very interesting.
Right.
And then I mean, I love Face, like serving Face. Like that feels like that's such like a, oh wow. Like you really, you know, there's a fine line of how you're serving that. Of like, you have to be very intentional, very direct, very right there, not stopping, you know, you need to, it is about the face, you know, but then also I feel like there's a subtle way.
Right.
Yes. There's a subtle way of doing it too. You let the
face speak for it. Yeah.
Right.
Or even doing body. Like there was one of the women who, cisgender women, she beat out the beautiful sexy chocolate house father of Gucci. I mean, his body is banging. And he was like, oh, clearly I'm going to win this category. He didn't. But the woman who did, she was like, you know, growing up, like I didn't think my body was, you know, beautiful. And, you know, she's a beautiful sized woman. You know, she was crying because she wasn't winning. And, you know, she just had never, and Megan Thee Stallion started crying too, because, you know, these are not what traditional society is like, okay, you're beautiful, you know, with your full body, you know? And so I love that. Like it is about, there's a confidence with any of the categories that you walk. Yeah. If you've never done it before, you just, it's a confidence that you exude and have to just carry, you know?
It's true. Trusting. You're right. A confidence and trusting, like all of it. It is such like a big, like I feel like the show, and when we're specifically talking about Legendary, I do feel like it is like a huge opportunity and experience for, you know, everyone going through that, you know, show and competition, you know, to yeah. grow and learn more about themselves.
They were competing in their own houses and stuff, but for them to get this platform, and they, like, it's a culture that yeah. should have been had this platform, because all of the other stuff that we watch in pop music and fashion is all on the heels and shoulders of what them and their houses and their families have created. And so now they're finally getting yeah. their real trophies and their real accolades. And I hope they're getting paid well to be on that show too. Okay. So then we get to Voguing, which a lot of y'all know. Right. And so Voguing is, you know, it's a nonviolent way of fighting during the ball. And there are three different versions of Vogue. So there's the old way that started in the 1960s. And that's basically posing, kind of emulating movements from fashion magazines, hence the name. And again, it was this opportunity for folks who were not going to get the cover of these magazines, the opportunity for them to show, hey, I can do this. I can embody this. I can, you know, do and be this. And then you had New Way, which developed in the 1980s. And this was, you know, dynamic, acrobatic, athletic, contortionist. It had some martial arts influences because Willie Ninja, the godfather of Vogue and the House of Ninja, developed this technique. And I will say that the one thing that did throw me and my roommate off when we're watching Legendary, the House of Ninja was all represented by like five cisgender women from different parts of the world. And so we were like, what? And like the House of Ebony, the mother is a cisgender straight white lady. So there's just very interesting. But all the folks in the judges panel, they were like, it's great that you're here. You're showing that, you know, vote that ball is a very large and big tent. And I was like, oh, okay, all right. Well, as long if y'all are okay with it, then fine. I will be too. But anyways, I have my thoughts. And then there's there's Vogue Femme, which started about the mid-90s, hyper effeminate posturing, intricate hand and arm movements. You also have like dips, the death drops. Like Vogue Femme is just like, it's all the things. You just be wilding out doing all the things. But those death drops, my knees, I don't know how. And they like, when you watch, they all as a house will just death drop, death drop, death drop. I can be the caller. I can be that guy. Kitty, 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 cat, 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 bow. Duck, walk, duck, duck, bow. I be gonna get it in your face. Kick, swam, get it in your face. Did I miss my calling?
Oh, wow. You know, you might be coming for, Legendary 3. Yeah. Season 3.
Yeah, you better watch out. What is it? Is Deshaun? You better watch out. Yeah, I'm coming for you. Okay. Gonna be the new host of the show. Gonna be the new host of the show. I got the mic. I got the mic. I got the mic. Get
drop back. All right. Okay. I see. I can see the potential.
Hey, you've got connections at HBO, so you know, hook it up. Hook it up. Hook it up.
I don't have connections.
Okay. Your blue thing is writing for Generation. Yes, hilarious. It is Deshaun Wesley. Also, the host, like they have Jamila Jamil is one of the guest judges. La Roach, who is just doing the most all the time. Does not like most things that anybody does. Like, he's a very tough judge, but that's what he's there for. Megan Thee Stallion. How do I say her name? Laomi?
Laomi. Yeah,
love her. Yes. Like, because she comes from Laomi. Ball and she knows the most about it. Like, and she just, I think her feedback is always on point and just really good.
Absolutely. She is a queen.
Queen. Yes. Queen, queen, queen.
The queen of ballroom. Yes. I love Laomi.
And then so ball has gone away from like it's gone away from pageantry and movie stars to more high fashion. Do you know what the five elements of Vogue are?
Okay. You know what? Tell me. What is it? Is it like all of the different things you have to include?
We named one already.
Is duck walking one?
It is. Okay, you're doing it. Duck walk. Okay.
Is serving face one?
No. That's an added bonus.
No, not face. No. Like, okay. Okay. All right. Duck walking. What's it called? Spins?
Spins and dips. Okay, you got it. Yeah. Duck walk, spins and dips.
Spins and dips. Oh my gosh. Okay. What is anything about like an what, like an entrance of some sort?
What is Naomi, like, what does Naomi, no. What does Naomi Campbell do? What is she
Oh, runway.
She
runway.
Walks on the
catwalk.
Yes. So catwalk. Duck walk, catwalk, okay. Spins and dips. And
oh, gosh,
I'm trying. What are these? Yeah. So the five elements of Vogue: hands, duck walk, catwalk, spins and dips, and floor work. And let's see, Willie Ninja, who appeared, he helped. So we're talking about mainstreaming, how it became, you know, mainstream. You know, he appeared in the Malcolm McLaren song Deep in Vogue and the music video. He also taught runway, and one of his students is Naomi Campbell. And so again, you have that ballroom is literally like teaching the high world of fashion. Like Willie Ninja helped, you know, create what we know as, like, you'd have these people from Ball who would teach these models how to walk. Madonna was introduced to it by Madonna was introduced to voguing by Jose Gutierrez Extravaganza and Luis Camacho Extravaganza in 1990, and through their that Vogue was one of her defining hits of her career. They'd also go on to tour with her as well. And then you had a Paris is Burning documentary by Jenny Livingston. And when the Grand Jury Prize, a little bit of exploitation through it. The folks who were in it were not necessarily paid what they needed to be paid. Didn't get their, you know, their accolades and things like that, that they, like, you know, deserve to have gotten. So there is, yeah, so that not great. It also reinforced gender, racial, and social stereotypes. And it was all the perspective from, like, you know, this white person, right? So great at the time, I guess. I mean, at least it was happening, but it could have been better. And then it's also like when we come to the end of this, you know, it's heartbreaking because most of the founders and creators of ballroom who sought fame and fortune, they never got it. And, you know, there's a lot of sexual violence against this community. AIDS wreaked havoc against the community. You know, Venus Extravaganza from Paris is Burning was murdered. I mean, even during the documentary, her mother, Angie Extravaganza, had, you know, mentioned that, you know, what happened to Venus was probably killed by a John. And then Angie herself died of AIDS-related complications. So did Dorian Corey, Willie Ninja. So it's like this whole, we lost these legends. I can't even imagine where we would be. And the government let this happen. Like, you know, Ronald Reagan didn't admit that or say the word AIDS. So like 1985, 1988, it was deep in. It had been raging for like 8 years, and he hadn't said anything. And you had like a community, Americans just dying. And then there was the Latex Ball in 1990 to bring awareness. I've been to the Latex Ball. It was wild. It was amazing. People, it's one of the world's largest balls. People from all over. And if you're looking into, what do I, you know, I want to dive even more into this world, definitely watch Legendary. There's a documentary called Kiki that came out in 2016. It, you know, it kind of is like the new Paris is Burning. And I highly recommend that. And, you know, you said this earlier, you know, balls were similar to us as actors. It was an escape from the real world, but it also provided a support from the community. And it's just definitely, we owe so much. It's now worldwide. There's houses like all over the globe, from Paris to Tokyo, St. Petersburg to Cape Town. Take a voguing class during Pride. Like, go to a voguing class, an authentic voguing class. Check the receipts, you know, if it's Karen, and maybe Karen's a part of a house, but just double check. Double check for the House of Karen. I'm gonna talk to the manager.
Congratulations, you've won a ticket to attend an exclusive opportunity in a relaxing environment with two lovers.
Wow. Well, this sounds like a sort of proposition of sorts, but really it's an ad for our podcast. Wonderful. It's a show we do here on Maximum Fun, where we talk about things that we like and things that we're into.
I'm Rachel McElroy, and you just heard Griffin McElroy, and we are excited for you to join us as we talk about movies and music and books.
Things like sneezing or the idea of rain.
Can you get news or information you can use?
Absolutely you cannot. Because we're here to talk to you about pumpernickel bread.
You can find new episodes on Wednesdays.
So catch the wave!
Avi's Corner! Avi's Corner! Cartoon realness! Ow, 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 ow! Boing!
All right, I liked it.
Awooga! Awooga!
Wow.
Boom! Good morning!
That, okay, was great. It wasn't necessary. It was a little bit in line with my no, but you know what? I think you even made it better. Hold on. You made it even better. You want to know why? Because it was a great introduction to the world of voice acting, animation, and cartoons. So yay. I really appreciate that.
Okay, there we go. Thank you. Woof, I didn't get chopped this week. Woof.
You did not get chopped. But yes, I am just here to try to talk about some LGBTQIA+ queer representation in kids' media. You know, we're talking about cartoons and animations, animated series. And I really felt my reason is because, yes, I'm starting to audition for more cartoons, which yeah. is super cool. But the roles are, you know, non-binary, they're queer, they're trans, you know, so it's super cool to
that's amazing
to be able to have an opportunity.
When I was getting voiceover auditions, it was for like a like goblin dad on a Nickelodeon show, and I love that you're getting to not have to do that. I'm like, oh, how do I do a goblin voice? And it's like I was just doing really bad sketch comedy, so I love that this is happening for you.
Yes. You know what's so funny? I feel
you
like
have to be a goblin.
We mentioned this last time too. I think when we were talking about like, because I think last year
yeah.
It started.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, and I love a goblin dad. That's pretty cool too, though. You know.
Something for everybody. We need everyone
there
to have
really
a presentation.
Is. There really is. Yes.
I don't know if we're going to... Okay, can we tag this into your corner? Because I feel like you're gonna get into this. You sent me something today. And yes. I was like, okay, let me watch this before we do the show.
Oh, my gosh.
And
yeah.
I almost cried. Yes. Can we talk about this before we dive in?
Let's.
I think it's a great... On the heels of what you're talking about. There's the Blue's Clues just released an LGBTQ themed sing-along video for Pride Month. It is so beautiful. I thought I was watching it and I almost just cried. I was like, I gotta record a show. I can't just break down in tears watching a Blue's Clues videos right now. It is so beautiful, and it's set to The Ants Go Marching, which is already already a bop. I think it's probably one of my favorite kids songs. I love a good counting and building on something, like, you know, take me on a journey. I want to learn how to count. What are the ants that 2x2 doing? Oh, that 3x3, what are they up to? And so it's set to that, and it's, you know, the families marching 2x2, and it's, and each one is, you know, progresses, and it is the most, like, I think it's the most inclusive queer thing I've probably ever seen, I think, in my life. Like, even in, like, non-children's media, this is probably the most inclusive and should be the theme of Pride. Play at all the Pride parade parties. I want the disco I want, like, the disco remix. I mean, it's so inclusive of, like, everyone in the queer community, I feel like, was represented from, you know, trans folks. There was a owl in a hijab. You know, there were, you know, ace people also were represented, like every part of the LGBTQIA+, like it was all there.
I mean, it, yes. And Nina West, right?
Nina West
from season
yeah.
RuPaul's. Yeah. It was also is singing, right? Is like featured.
Yep.
And singing
it's like hosting the Pride parade and singing the song. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, no, it's super, I mean, it's great. And that's why I'm like, it begged the question, like, yes or no, should things like this exist in kids media? Should our youth be quote, quote, exposed. Right. And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Like, it should be. It should be. Like, yes. Absolutely.
And I think
no ands, ifs, or buts.
For the protection of the families, because our families are, there are queer people in everyone's families, and there are people who have, like, queer heads of households, and to make it safe for these children to exist and to go to school, by normalizing these different families, I'm sure there are many a child and parent who saw this video and also just cried because they felt, like, seen. You know, and they could leave it to, and again, this goes back to Nickelodeon, as we were talking about earlier, like Nickelodeon, I think the, you know, the creator of Blue's Clues, also a woman, also currently the lead of Blue's Clues is an Asian American man, which I also love. I think Josh is his name. Josh. I don't know. I didn't watch this season, so I don't know. I didn't.
Nor did I, but.
Okay. Put it on the list. We'll put it on the list. We'll add it to the Netflix. Put it on my queue.
But no, yeah, you're right. Yes, like speaking to Nickelodeon and like the content that they were already producing and creating and putting out there. But speaking of Nickelodeon also, aren't they, what is the reveal around Betty? Is
oh
it?
My right? goddess, yes. So Blue,
Phil
again,
and Dill.
Nickelodeon, Phil and Lil. They're
Phil and Dill.
There is a Dill, though, I think. Someone's brother got named
it's
Dill.
The,
I don't
know. It's the brother. Tommy's brother is Dill. Oh, that,
which is also weird, then, because then it's like Phil, Lil, and then, oh, yeah, our friend Dill. I don't know. Dill. That's weird. What was?
Anyways, but Betty.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe Tommy, that's Tommy's half-brother. Maybe Dee Dee was getting wild with.
Okay, don't be making all these
with
things
with Mr.
Now.
DeVille. Okay. But on Tuesday, it was confirmed. So they're doing a Rugrats reboot. And it was confirmed. Like, we always saw that, like, Betty DeVille, like, you know, she was a strong feminist and all that sort of stuff. Anyways, Betty's going to be coming back as an openly gay woman. And she's was already voiced by queer actor Natalie Morales. And so now she's coming back onto the show as her full queer self. What a lovely, lovely.
We love it. We love to see it. It's exciting. And I mean, it kind of falls in line. Oh, go ahead. Was there something else?
Well, I was going to add one other one is that the Madagascar cartoon what? Will soon welcome its first non-binary character as well. Yeah.
Yes. Little known fact. I auditioned for that role.
Did you audition for that? Okay. Oh, should we not be? I'm sorry. Is this.
No, whoever got it, I think it's Ezra. I believe their name is Ezra. Oh gosh, I needed to look. I was trying to research because Ezra uses, let me find it. Minas?
Yes, Ezra Minas.
Yes.
They recently played a non-binary character on the CW's Batwoman.
Yes.
And they're also going to be in the West Side Story film remake. Look at you, up with the big... Up with the big folks. Hey.
Yeah, we know. We're here. We're trying. We're doing it. But yeah, that's exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, still having
queer.
That.
We
and I feel the push. That's what I'm saying. I feel the push around casting, you know, getting, because trans, non-binary actors, we exist, right? So, like, we're here. And, like, we do, I don't know. I can't speak for everyone. I want a voice, you know. Those roles, if as so long as they're being written, you know, too. So I'm so happy, and it's like again, their success is my success, and it's super 100% exciting.
Legal lineage. Well, and what I love is like, yeah, let's just open up the stories of people like these, like queer and non-binary and trans people have always existed. So let's just create space for them to also participate in these stories. Like they're there. It's not like we're.
Yeah.
It's not like there's new people showing up to the scene. Right?
Exactly.
These people who've always been here. And so let's just broaden our stories. And we can still tell the same stories. We want to tell Jurassic Park? Great. And one of the characters can also be non-binary. And it just so happens to be. It doesn't have to be a main focus. And they're like, okay, let's talk about, not every movie has to be specifically about that person's identity and experience. They can just sort of be there. So it's just like all we're asking is just open up who's involved in the stories. Who's there?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. And I think you used the my favorite word, normalize it, you know, normalizing it is exactly
I want to see you running away from dinosaurs. I could see it.
I'm ready. But I mean, it wasn't always the case with cartoons, right? It's like you could assume, and if you like go way, this is where I was trying to go back into history and trying to be like, like I found phrases like queer coding, queer baiting. And I think queer coding exists pretty much in like general media, like TV and film stuff, but especially in cartoons too, I think, where there are theories and people have opinions around specifically like Disney villains. Like I saw a video where it was like people were saying like, you know, there was queer coding like for Jafar in Aladdin or Hades in Hercules.
Ursula.
Ursula.
Also Gaston. You know, stereotypical muscle gym muscle bunny. The one from Pocahontas, you know, the little pug, his little pug dog, forgot his name. But it did, I think this was in the, I think I saw this too, like in the celluloid closet. And there was a thing that they would do with these queer coatings, and they would put like stereotypical queer identifiers onto villains.
Right.
And so then what ends up happening is kids see those, and when they see them in real life, if you have a lisp or if you, you know, dress in a certain way, well, then you're the villain. I'm going to make it, it teaches you that those things are bad at a very young, early age. And so what's so beautiful with animation is you just show it as like you normalize, oh, this person is just here and they just are existing, you know. It's just, it's going to be a move over Generation Z. Y'all about to be tired too. They're about to be like, what y'all, y'all not doing enough. Just you wait. This next one, this next generation coming up.
It's true. It's true. We, you know, and I think this is what, why it's such an exciting time to be alive, to be here. And you know, I'm again, I'm just excited to see the growth of, be a part of the growth of an industry and of a movement. I think, yes, it is exciting, you know, but I know at the end of the day, sometimes why it has taken so long is like fear, you know, networks being afraid of, you know, pissing someone off or losing a large demographic of viewers and subscribers. And, you know, it's playing that
advertisers.
Like, how do I need to, appeasing, placating, you know, it's, but it is blatant homophobia and transphobia and erasure, you know, at play, which is why now it's like it is exciting to see these networks and companies and corporations being like, hey, no, here. Like we're going to make changes now. But it is interesting to talk about queer baiting really quick, where that I came across that too, where it was like, you know, people are like, oh, you're just saying that. Like this character is part of the alphabet mafia, you know, you're just giving that to us, but like, where is it in the story? Like, you can't just be like, oh yeah, actually this character is gay or was queer.
Like they feel like they did, Disney got a little flack for that. Cause they're like, oh, it's our first openly gay character in Cruella. But there were, people were like, this is like your seventh. You kept saying that. Like you were like, oh, one of the princesses in Frozen, or it's like a blink if you miss it one. Or even like, I think the guy in Beauty and the Beast, Gaston LeFou, they're like, oh, he gay. And they're like, okay, but he does dance with the guy at the very, very end. But like, it is like these sort of like blink if you miss it. I will say like some people are kind of giving the new Sex and the City a little flack because they're saying like, oh, this
let me get this because
they think it's just, you know, queer baiting. But I'm going to hold off and wait and see because you have Sarah Ramirez, their new character.
They're Shay.
They're playing a non-binary queer stand-up and podcast host. And for me, they hit a lot of the things that I love. Podcast host, check. Queer, check. Non-baiting. And so they might get my peepers, my little peepers might clue on in because, you know, and because for me, it's like if I feel like I'm included, I will probably take that bait. Like if I feel like I am a part of it. So like it's in some ways, it's, you know, marketing, but like I'd rather be included than not. But I do think you should like, but how are they being represented? Are they just kind of like a barely there queer person, which happens a lot, or, you know, they're queer in name only.
Yeah, I get that. That's super. That's true. You know, I mean, I don't know. I never watched Sex and the City, but I'm willing to. You're right. I love what you said about.
That's not true.
Okay, I saw the movie.
You
one.
Have seen
the one movie.
There we go.
Movie
same.
One. Movie
I've
one.
Seen the only.
But I like
know.
What you
it's
said
same.
About like
you're
when,
not on trial here. It's fine.
Okay. I love what you said about when you can see yourself in something, like it makes you more interested, like more willing and curious.
Yeah.
About watching.
It's why I've seen all 8 of the Fast and the Furious movies.
Oh, wow.
Because I feel represented in it. You should too. They got you. They got the little Latinx running around.
Oh my God.
Several.
Stop.
Several.
Oh my goodness. Oh my gosh. But
and lots of great eye candy and something for everybody up in it. So you better run on. I'll give you my Amazon Prime password. You can,
oh my goodness.
You can catch on up.
My gosh. You're hilarious. Yeah, cartoons. You gotta love them. We grew up on them, you know. and
they're
yeah.
doing better. They're doing good stuff.
I think they are making bigger strides.
Yeah, yeah. And I think too. I think that there's sometimes more freedom in animation based on the Nickelodeon documentary. Sometimes like they kind of are letting. They're not watching for some reason with as much of a scrutinized eye. Like Rocko's Modern Life got away with a lot of shit. I was like, this as an adult watching it again. Mm. It's like, whoa, this is pretty raunch. And I think that sometimes some shows are able to get away with some, not even that they need to get away with anything, but in some ways, like we need to have these conversations and we need to tell these stories to these folks, because it's so hard being a kid. And if you can get them while they're young to just show that, like, you know, love is love. People are who they are. Love and respect everybody is what it really comes down to. And I feel like, you know,
yeah.
the cartoons are the best space to do that. And for people to see, feel seen in these stories, it makes the world of difference.
Absolutely. And I really want to commend the creators for even, you know, being the ones that are championing a lot of these stories, because it's like without them, they're the ones that are being persistent with networks who are often getting a lot of pushback and oftentimes are being told no. Mm. And then I was researching and two creators, I think the creators of Steven Universe and then the creator from a series called Gravity Falls, they were like, we got notes back and it was like, you can't have this. And it was like two characters that appear to be the same gender or, you know, in terms of presentation. And they're like holding hands or something. And it's like, no, you can't have that. That's inappropriate. To where then the creators are being like, really coming back with the simple question, why? And then the higher ups are like stumped by that question and they're like, right. Okay. Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Just go ahead. Keep it. You know, you know, so.
Yeah. Cause they're like, we don't have a relationship. Yeah. Yeah. I know like in DuckTales, the new DuckTales series, there were two gay dads in it who had appeared. I think Craig of the Creek, there was another character who came out, like I think it was maybe on Craig of the Creek, and he came out to a friend of his and that he was bisexual, and it was like not a big deal at all.
Yeah.
And so you have these cartoons that they're doing it. Listen, kids don't care about this shit. It's these leftover adults who have these hangups. And I think people would be so much happier in the world. I think you have so much war and strife because people are not able to live their full, true, authentic self.
Yeah.
And that comes out in dangerous ways when people cannot authentically be their own selves and feel like they have to be an idea of something. I think you would see a decrease in, you know, mass shootings, war, violence, if you just let people safely be their selves. You know, homophobia and gender laws and constructs, it hurts and affects everybody. Like even if you're a straight person, you're hurt and affected by it.
Stop hurting us. You know when we just gotta like break into song. Okay, I
sing
really just
out.
Wanna wrap up my corner
you
by
saying. Just
gotta
sing it out.
That, you know, Disney has a history, right? There's a history with Disney. But I do just, I you know, they are also making strides. And I do want to give a shout out to Dana Terrace, who was part of DuckTales, but also is the creator of an animated series on Disney called The Owl House. And The Owl House features Disney's first bisexual lead, Luz Noceda. And I'm just really excited. There was a season, there's a season one, and season two is going to be airing on June 12th. And I'm just excited to see how Dana continues to normalize and include LGBTQIA plus representation and characters. So I'm just going to say that.
I absolutely agree. I love the progress and stuff that is happening. We did not have this when I was a kid, but we had, you know, weird looking Rugrat babies. And now their moms are lesbians. So it all comes full circle. And I can't wait to see what the next generation does. Oh, this is so great. And also bringing in like the update of, you know, queer animation and where it is, especially because this is your medium and your world. And it's so exciting to see you a part of it. And you're part of these trailblazers who are doing this amazing work. So snap, snap, snaps. Tens across the board. You slayed. Voiceover realness. 10 points. Wow. No chop.
What an honor. Thank you.
You are taking home the legendary trophy for voiceover realness on the Minority Corner Ball.
I love. Yes, Minority Corner Ball. Oh, wow. This is,
yes,
I've made
you
it.
Have.
To me,
yes,
this,
you have.
That's it.
Yes,
I've made
you have,
it.
Your Highness. Yes, you have.
Oh, well, it's always a pleasure, and thank you. I love you forever. Happy Pride!
This is just the beginning. And there you have it. So much greatness. Really quick fact check. Ronald Reagan, it was 1985 where he finally acknowledged that AIDS was an epidemic happening in the country, already killing thousands of Americans. And we meant to talk about this, but, you know, too many things, so little time. We will link this, but there are three really great documentaries you should definitely check out about Tulsa 100 years later. We will link them in the show notes. Some really great ones. There's Tulsa Burning on the History Network. There is Dreamland, The Burning of Black Wall Street on CNN. And Tulsa, The Fire and the Forgotten Trailer. So really great insights that both of them have done. And you can also go into our back catalog in Minority Corner. We have covered it a few different times. So that is the show. Happy Pride. And big thanks to our editor, Sarah Brown, our production coordinator, Lori Fowler, and to all of our Maximum Fun members, because y'all help just keep the wheels turning. And to all of you listeners, we love you so much. Thank you for listening to Minority Corner, because together we're the majority. Love ya.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.